Hey everyone, this is Joe Turner, and this is going to be our first episode in the Recruiter Series. This is where I'm going to go and talk to different recruiters from different recruitment firms, and we're going to talk about not only their recruitment process, but the current state of recruitment in the public sector. And this is designed to give you as a candidate or future candidate a better idea of how the process works so that you can be more competitive and put your best foot forward in future recruitments, help you prepare for those, and just help you just be a better candidate. Before we jump into the episode, I have two main announcements I want to shoot out for you here. The first one is next week's episode is going to be with a city manager who was arrested for a serious crime and didn't get fired. They were arrested. They were booked. It's going to be a pretty powerful episode. The conversation was meant to talk about a specific topic and this veered off into a different territory. And so what we're going to do is I'm going to split this next podcast series into two parts. Part one will be next week, so do not miss that episode. I think you're going to like it, and I'll follow up with part two after that. I'm really excited about that episode. I think you're going to enjoy it. I think you're going to find it very entertaining, very informative. I found it very riveting. And so please check that out. The second announcement is I get a lot of city managers, a lot of public sector executives who reach out to me. They message me and they say, I really enjoy your content. Thank you for putting it out there. It's so valuable, so useful. How can I support you? What can I do to support you and what you're trying to accomplish on LinkedIn and the podcast? And I'm going to tell you what you can do. First, obviously, you can donate money. We've talked about that before with the Buy Me a Coffee link, right? buymeacoffee.com/city manager unfiltered. There's a link in the show notes if you want to donate directly to the podcast to help me recover my costs and expenses for putting this podcast together. But there's a way you can support me that doesn't cost you a penny. And in fact, it will help you and your organization. And that is by running your job listing for a senior level executive position in my newsletter, my weekly newsletter that I'm putting out on LinkedIn, right? As you know, I've started the newsletter a few weeks ago. It's called City Manager RTRs and Job Board. And that's where I put out the list of city managers who've either resigned, been terminated, or announced their retirement in the preceding week. And on top of that, I'm including jobs from various recruiters who are participating and local government entities who are putting in their department heads and their assistant city manager positions or their city manager recruitments if they're doing it in-house. So if you want to support what I'm doing, if you like what I'm doing, and you want to actually help your organization at the same time, put your job listing in the newsletter. It's very cheap. It's only $100. And you can get national exposure. It's the fastest growing local government newsletter on LinkedIn. I had over 5,000 subscribers in just 3 weeks. And it's going to continue to grow as I promote it on the platform, on the podcast. So if you really like what I'm doing, you want to support what I'm doing, please put your job listing in that newsletter. Again, won't cost you anything. And it will also help you fill your vacancy because I got national exposure with a highly targeted audience of public sector executives. If you'd like to put your job in the newsletter, simply click on the link in the show notes. It's a short form, small form for you to fill out, and I'll get that published the next week's edition. Now let's turn to this episode with Michael Bays of Clear Career Professionals. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you. All right. I'm Joe Turner, and this is the City Manager Unfiltered Podcast, a podcast for city managers and other public sector executives. Been looking forward to having this guest on the show for quite some time. I've talked about it been over the last several months on posts and whatnot about having a recruiter series where we can talk to the various public sector recruiters and get an idea of what their processes are like. That way, the candidates and the city managers who are listening to the podcast can have a better understanding of what their process is and how to navigate those recruitments to put the best foot forward. So today, I have Michael Bays with us. He's with Clear Career Professionals, and he's a relatively newer entry into the public sector executive recruitment space. Mike, why don't you do a brief introduction and talk about how you got into the executive recruitment space, and then we'll jump into a more in-depth discussion about how you work and what your processes are.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we appreciate you for having us on, Joe, and I like that Pink Floyd shirt, rocking it on this Saturday. It's kind of an interesting journey. I'll just talk a little bit about, I was working as a city manager down in Wimberley and had decided to retire and kind of move back up to the Dallas area. Talked it over with a close friend of mine, Deanna Hendricks, who was working with Texas Workforce Commission at the time. We'd kind of looked at the space and saw, some of the recruitment firms that were out there and kind of what their processes were. And some of our colleagues and, in our personal interactions hadn't always had the best experiences with those firms. We were like, hey, maybe we can get into this space and offer a little bit of a different product. We connected with Kent Myers, who was retiring from Fredericksburg. you know, after a 40-year city manager career right around that same time, quickly just it merged into kind of a vision of what Clear Career Professionals could become and kind of kicked that off. So, you know, we started in October of 2022. And, you know, really had a very productive year last year. And I think as we kind of get into more a little about Clear Career, I think we have some differences from other firms. And so just really happy to talk about, you know, the industry, you know, kind of where we see the industry going and just, you know, how the relationships have formed over the last year and a half.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm pretty anal about trying to stay on top of all the different recruiters in the space, even before I started posting on LinkedIn. And I remember when you popped up on LinkedIn, I might have been one of the first half dozen or so folks that followed your page because I saw you guys. I'm like, oh, these are some new players. And, you know, what really kind of brings us together today, even though this has been in the works for many months, is that one of my buddies, you know, texted me out of the blue. This is many, many months ago. And was singing your praises and talked about how he went through this really great process with you guys and the communication was fantastic. And he just sang your praises. And I was like, oh, I got to pay more attention to what, you know, Mike and his outfit's doing. And so I know you've been getting a lot of good publicity, good feedback from your candidates that you've been working with, as well as your clients that you've been working with.
Yeah. You know, something we did early on is I had known Warren. I'm gonna mess up his last name. Warren Hushmaker. You know, he runs Sumner Consulting, and I think he's a fellow of yours. But he had been in Texas and moved to Georgia and kind of started a recruitment business down there. So right when we started considering, you know, the recruitment business, I had reached out to him and kind of saw what his experiences were, and he was very gracious and kind of talked about the field and kind of some of things that he had learned in starting that. And so we came back and we really developed, you know, some core values of what our firm was going to be, because we call ourselves a candidate focused firm, and people always ask us, you know, what does that mean? And one thing that means is making sure that there is a clear expectation of what the position you're applying for is going to be. So if there's a challenging city council, you know, there's challenges in the city, whether it's infrastructure or employee benefits, we want to know those things so that when we're recruiting, we don't always want to just talk about the positives of a city. We want to talk about the challenges. We want to make sure the candidates understand what they're getting into. And then the other thing that we want to make sure we do is always communicate with the candidates. So we call, you know, every candidate every week, or at least we strive to. If we miss you and you're not answering the phone or you're busy, we'll shoot you an email with just any updates. And then at the end of a process, one of the most tricky things is we make a phone call to let people know they didn't get the job.
What a novel concept. Yeah. What a novel concept, Mike.
Yeah. And, you know, I hated, you know, as an applicant through the processes, you know, sometimes you'd get an email saying, hey, you know, we've hired somebody else. And sometimes you'd just see it on a news story or a LinkedIn post. You'd put in a ton of work and you'd be like, what the hell
happens all the time? All the time. You know, that has been the biggest frustration. That if I could say one of the most frustrating things about working with public sector recruiters that I get from my peers, colleagues, what have you, is the piss poor communication. And an extension of that is finding out that somebody else got the job through a newspaper clipping, right? Or through a Joe Turner posting on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
I mean, it just boggles my mind that something that is really so easy and so fundamental is ignored or missed by so many recruiters. And it's happened to me. It's happened to other, obviously, I mean, it's happened to tons of people. And it's like, how hard is it really to have that communication? It's frustrating. And that's one of the things that you get really high marks on. Like I said, going back to my buddy who reached out to me, and I went through one of your processes, actually, and you were communication was excellent with you as well. And so I can speak from firsthand experience. You touched on something a little bit earlier that I think is something that I harp on a little bit in my posts, and a lot of us have frustrations, is that, yes, we are candidates and we are not paying you for your services, right? We're not a direct customer, but we are a secondary customer. And I feel a lot of times, and I had this conversation with Jordan Cook a little bit in a previous podcast episode, is I think recruiters, it's tough. We're in a market where it's tough to get candidates. The pools are thin. But, you know, there's times when these recruiters, they know information about the recruitment that they're not sharing with the candidates. And I find that frustrating. And at the end of the day, and I've talked about this in other podcasts as well, we're not trying to go out on a date here, right? Like, I'm not just hitting you up and trying to, you know, let's go on a quick date. This is a quasi marriage, right? I mean, so you need to know all the warts, all the challenges, all the things that go with it. Because at the end of the day, the candidate needs to know, go in with eyes wide open. And the city or county also needs to go with eyes wide open on the candidate. So I feel like there needs to be a greater discussion about, hey, we're not just trying to give our best impressions, right? And we're trying to impress everybody. Let's talk about who we really are. What are my strengths and weaknesses as a candidate? And what is the city's strengths and weaknesses? You know, is the governing body meddling? Is the, you know, do you have some pretty tough elected officials who have a history of riding their manager? You know what I mean? That kind of stuff. And so it really makes me feel good when you talk about the importance of focusing on the candidate and sharing information with these managers. And I don't want to go on for a long rant here, but at the end of the day, some managers really want a challenge. And I think the city should be wanting to find those managers that want that challenge.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and we have, you know, kind of a process that we go through when we see a city that has an open position. You know, we usually have an internal discussion about, is that a city we feel like we could recruit for? Is that a city where we would be comfortable, you know, me calling Joe up and going, hey, Joe, this is a good opportunity. You should apply for this position. And feel good that, you know, if you get it, you have an opportunity for success there. We really try to evaluate some cities and go, is this a possibility that the city has a lot of dysfunction, but with the right city manager, that could be the right mix that could carry the city, you know, at least to a functioning and maybe to a higher level of service to the community. We sometimes don't put in for positions just because things are going on in the city where we just feel like we couldn't honestly recommend one of our friends working there. And I mean, gotcha. I say friends in general, like, you know, somebody who I'm going to see at the, you know, city manager conference and come up to me and go, hey, why did you guys not tell me that there was challenges with this position?
Right.
So, you know, we really try to vet that. And then I think that fit is super important, because if you just took and recruited for cities that had no problems, then we would never have a city to work for, because every city has some sort of challenge, or generally there wouldn't be an opening there. I mean, I know there's sometimes just people have reached their retirement, but generally speaking, there's been a change in council, there's been a change in leadership, and there's some issue that is sitting there, and really trying to get in and understand that issue from having sat in that seat before as a city manager. And then when we recruit, people being able to say, hey, what do you see are the challenges, and how can I use my, you know, unique skills and ability to bring that organization to another level, is really the process that I think brings a relationship in the full circle and sets up, you know, the community and the candidate for success.
Right, right. Let's talk about this process that basically you compete for, a city, a contract or whatnot. You're awarded that contract. Can you walk us through the processes? It might be a little bit of a difficult question to answer to some degree, because I recognize that there's going to be some cities and counties that have their own sort of unique wrinkle they want to throw into the process. But can you speak about the hard structure that you use and operate within? And then maybe we can branch out to some of the things that you're a little bit more flexible and based off of the person, the individual customer's desires or wants or needs.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, kind of one thing that we identified as having been previous candidates ourselves was sometimes the amount of copious work that goes into putting in for one of these positions. And a lot of times, you know, you have a full-time job, you're either a full-time manager or ACM or a department head that's running much more than 40 hours a week at your current organization. And you put in for one of these positions and they're asking you to do copious amounts of work to continue in the selection process. If it's necessary to do that to find a good candidate, that may be understandable, but frequently the city boards and commissions aren't reading those 20 or 30 page documents you're preparing. You know, it's more of kind of a survival game, sort of like on Survivor, like, you know, who will at least complete this 20 or 30 page paper. And then that narrows our field down more. And so we saw that kind of as a potential waste of a lot of resources there. So, you know, what we generally do is we take a look at the cover letter and resume, and I'll talk a little bit more about why the cover letter is important later on, but, you know, we'll get cover letters and resumes in from candidates. Throughout that process, while we're talking with candidates, you know, over the week, you know, while we're accepting candidates, you sort of get to know them, or at least our client relationships team does. You know, they'll talk and sometimes be polite on the phone. You'll catch sometimes if they're, you know, rude to our client candidate, you know, person, you know, that's kind of a clue of like, hey, is that something that we should look out for in the future? Is, you know, if you're being mean to people who are, you know, trying to help you get a position, should we kind of watch out for that? But yeah, really, absolutely. I mean, just kind of, you know, getting to know the candidates over that selection period time. And then we work with the selection committee, however the city wants to set that up, on selecting final or semi-finalists that they want to bring in for interviews. And we use a virtual interview process. So what will happen is we typically do a 30-minute virtual interview with active or retired city managers. It might be, you know, myself and Kent and, you know, Kelly Kinsler, who's a retired city manager here in Texas, is also one of our group. Or if we're not available, we'll bring in somebody that's either retired or current in the field. And we sit down and we spend 30 minutes with the candidates and kind of try to get to know them. The questions differ depending on the community and what the challenges may be. And then at the end of that, you know, we record that virtual interview. We sit down with the selection committee and kind of determine who do they want to move forward in the process, kind of those people that they want to move forward with will get a one-page leadership profile that just talks about, hey, tell me about your leadership strengths. Tell me how you would kind of manage organization. Well, our issue is we want to kind of confine that to a smaller document, because then you really have to focus on what's important. Typically, you know, if I'm paying, you know, if I've got 5 pages to write, then, you know, as an educated city manager, I can write a number of different things. But we really want you to focus on, you know, what are your top things? And so it kind of allows us to see, you know, some of that vetting process. And then really just kind of going through the process, backgrounds and things with the folks that they're going to interview, and then being on site with the city to kind of facilitate that process. So really the simplicity of our process, it kind of makes it an easier thing to go through for the candidates. But I think we're still really vetting the candidates well and having a really good understanding of who we're talking to and their potential ability to help the communities out.
So let me summarize this then. So candidates come in, all your candidates come in, and let's just say you have any town, Texas, right? I know you do a lot of work in Texas.
Yeah.
And let's just say you have 30 candidates come in for this vacancy. Do all 30 sit down for this half hour interview video conference, or do you weed that list down based off of some basic criteria to get down to that list before you go to that point?
Yeah, we will weed that field down. Let's say we had 30 candidates. We would, you know, work with a selection committee on reviewing the cover letter, resume. A lot of times we'll kind of hit the media kind of early on to see, you know, what were the issues in their career or what were their achievements. You know, you're kind of getting a feel for things that way. That's why for us, the cover letter is super important. And I always will tell candidates the cover letter isn't a synopsis of your resume.
It's your
ability to kind of sell your vision for the organization that you're applying for. You kind of understand how you know the strengths and weaknesses of the organization from an outside perspective. I mean, I know you're not going to get in there and go, hey, we're $30,000 short on this, you know, particular line item. But from a overarching perspective, do you kind of know the community's challenges and opportunities, and how do those play into your strengths and your weaknesses? And in that cover letter, kind of cover those things to where, you know, a selection committee can read and go, hey, this may be a really good fit. And then you have your resume going, hey, look at all these credentials that he has, all this experience in education. And so that's kind of what the selection committee uses to kind of vet down the pool of candidates.
So when it comes to Clear Career, you guys show every candidate to the selection, the city or selection committee, some representatives at the city, they see every single candidate that comes through. You don't just pair out some and then show them the top tier or whatnot. You don't do any cut down in that respect. Everyone who applies for the position gets seen by that selection committee for that community. Is that how you work?
Yeah, typically that is how it works. Now we may recommend 8 to 10.
Absolutely.
That we go, hey, we really feel based on our evaluation of the, you know, cover letter, resumes, what we know about the candidates, these are people who we would recommend for the position. But they see everybody and they get to go through that process. What we always want to make sure is that the hiring body feels like they're driving the bus. We can kind of help by guiding them, giving them directions. But at the end of the day, it's going to be somebody who's going to be a part of their team. And so the last thing we want the hiring body to do is go, hey, we feel like we were pushed in this way or, you know,
right,
kind of influenced. And so while we try to, you know, help guide to a qualified individual, we really want to make sure that they're making the selection on their own.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, we chat, you know, we have chatter or whatnot. And some of us wonder, you know, sometimes we don't know if some recruiters, they are showing the entire list of candidates or if they're paring it down, you know. And I think at the end of the day, I think every candidate wants to feel like they have a puncher's chance and that the city got to see them on a list or their resume or whatnot. So it's good to hear from you that your style or your process is that the selection committee or the community itself, the governing body, they all see all the candidates. Perfectly understandable to have a recommendations or a tier or a breakdown, but obviously that opens up to some manipulation. I guess it can be. I'm not saying you're manipulating the process, but I know that leads into some questions I've had presented to me by other managers about different types of recruitment firms where other former city managers are working for those recruitment firms. That's, you know, it's a very incestuous sort of industry in that regard, and I don't even mean that in a negative way. It's just, you know, it's very insular, and so there has been some questions asked of me of like, you know, hey, do you feel like certain recruiters are manipulating the process in terms of putting certain people forward or not advancing certain people in the process, you know? So but I'm glad to hear that they're seeing all the different candidates. So you go through this process then of having the selection committee look at the and reviewing the videotapes and what have you, and then you guys get down to a is it a list of finalists at that point, or is it like a second semifinalist stage?
No, we get to a list of finalists. So from the semifinalist interview, like say we do 10 of those, you know, for it's usually 8 to 10 people that we'll interview on those video recordings.
Got you.
We'll, you know, have those discussions, and then we share all of those videos with the selection committee too. So you're not just getting, you know, 3 or 4, you're getting all 10. Again, we'll make recommendations like, hey, we really like these 4. Sometimes we've recommended 5 or 6. You know, we can't go, hey, this person is significantly different than anybody else. So we'll go, hey, we're going to give you everybody who's on, you know, what we feel is the best tier. But you get everybody. And, you know, and we've had a city before that didn't take our recommendation. They reached down and said, hey, no, we like, you know, number 8 or 9, you know, somebody else on the list. And that's who they ended up hiring. And we're really good with that, because like at the end of the day, again, we really want them to feel like this was their hire. Through those semifinalist interviews, it's amazing what you see in 30 minutes. And part of our deal is the 30 minutes is so important because the selection committee does watch all of those videos. And so we want them to be really focused in on the candidates. We don't want them to skip somebody. So keeping them, you know, at a manageable window is important. And then you can also see how emotionally intelligent some candidates are in that, you know, because we tell our candidates it's going to be 30 minutes. So don't spend 18 minutes on question number 1.
Right.
And you can kind of see their emotional intelligence there a little bit to go, hey, you know, I understand this isn't going to be a hurry, but I do need to get the important things out. And kind of how do I interact in this, you know, atmosphere is kind of an important evaluation step.
So, you know, we're in 2024 now. We're a few years past the pandemic where we've all been exposed to Zoom meetings and conference calls and interviews and things of that sort of nature. What generally are some of the things that you see in a strong performer when it comes to these 30-minute video interviews? Who's presenting themselves well? What are they doing? Can you hit on that a little bit so folks who are listening at home can maybe practice and be more cognizant of that?
Yeah, I think understanding your own leadership characteristics is really important. You know, a lot of times we get in the city management field and then we stop interviewing for positions. You spend, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 years in a certain position, and maybe you're not interviewing, you're interviewing other people, but you allow your own kind of weaknesses to set in. And so when you're sitting, you know, either with us and even more so, you know, hopefully we get to talk a little bit later, but when you sit in front of the hiring body, the ability to build relationships in that window is a very important thing. What you're not trying to do is win by a preponderance of the evidence. You may sit down with a candidate, and typically, you know, some candidates will sit down and talk about everything that they've done. And it's all very impressive. But if I list 150 things that I've done, but I don't focus on building that relationship with whoever is interviewing me, or kind of how do I interact with you as a person, then that list isn't taken into consideration by the hiring body as much. They want people who are authentic and can kind of go, hey, here's what I've done, but let me interact with you.
Let's unpack that a little bit, because I've often said before in my interviews, I try to make it more of a conversation as opposed to an interrogation, right? So, you know, back and forth, I try to engage the other folks in the room per se. Now, these video interviews that you're doing, is like a round robin style where multiple individuals are asking a specific question on Zoom?
Yeah. So we'll always have 3 interview panelists. And then those 3 will take turns on asking either 10 or 11 questions in that 30-minute window.
So how do these strong performers build a relationship or connection? What do you see them do that sets them apart from other candidates?
Yeah, no, I think it's the ability to kind of be able to tell your story in a concise way, but then allow that interaction to happen. So one of the benefits that we feel like, as opposed to having a candidate sit in front of a green screen, for instance, and let them record 10-minute answers or 5-minute answers without anybody interacting, is the ability to kind of dig deeper into the question. So if we're talking about your experience in, you know, municipal budgeting and finance, you may have kind of a, you know, 1 or 2 minute answer on that. And then we can unpack that a little bit more, and we can go, okay, you've been at a city that had a fire department before. And as we all know, you know, fire department pay can be sometimes a real, you know, cumbersome thing to manage with their different shifts and things. If you're going to go to a city where maybe that's an issue, maybe that's, we've identified that, we want to unpack that a little bit more. And then you can talk about some of the things you've done with fire department pay. That way the selection committee is really getting to see you as an entire candidate and not just a really quick answer. But I do think that interaction is so important. And sometimes, you know, people have awkward humor that doesn't always play well. And
I was just going to ask you about sense of humor, because it could be a double-edged sword, right? Yeah. I mean, I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And I think I think it's okay to be personable as long as it's authentic, but what you don't want to do is make it come off as, you know, kind of, you know, off the cuff that seems like you're weird. Cause, you know, we've had some candidates where we show the videos and they're really qualified candidates, and the councils are just like, man, that's too much. You know, they're trying to be funny. And I think if that's kind of where, like, if you get nervous and that's kind of your fallback, then that can be a thing that maybe they don't like.
Something I've talked about with some peers about making it to the finals, you know, because obviously when you make it to the finals, you're, say you're the final three and you don't get the position, right? You can be pretty dejected or demoralized because, you know, hey, I didn't get the offer. I didn't get the job. And I try to make the argument that at that point, it's not really, if you get to be the finalist, you've won. Okay. Because at that point, it's just the best fit, right? Trying to find the best fit for the position. Yeah. And I think a lot of it honestly has to do with how you look on a resume and how you look on paper and how polished you might be. But at the end of the day, Mike, I mean, how much of it is just connecting in a human way with the governing body and being like, man, I can work with this person, or I like this person's personality. They're just a good fit, you know, personality wise. Isn't that a huge factor when it comes down to just the final three or final four might be?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, authenticity has a certain energy. You know, when you either meet somebody online, you know, it's a little bit harder online, but, you know, specifically in person, you can feel whether they're being authentic with you. There's a certain energy that we just get from people. And it's not even necessarily in the professional environment, but it's kind of what we've all learned throughout our lives. And so when you can come in and connect with somebody authentically and then build that relationship, and you know, some of our best processes, and as far as the finalist interviews go, I mean, that might look different for each city. You know, I've had some cities bring in all the finalists and do a tour with them, and then a lunch where they're all together, all the finalists are.
Yeah, it's weird. I always find that awkward.
Yeah, you know, I initially wasn't a fan of that, but sometimes what I see really happening is those people who are just relationship based, you know, they start becoming kind of friends with the other finalists in that short period of time, and you kind of get to see some really interesting, you know, personnel dynamics.
So you think it has value, huh? Really? Because yeah. I've poo-pooed those in the past, but you think they have value?
I do. I think in especially in a city manager role, we're going to be dropped into situations pretty frequently that are maybe uncomfortable, where we're not, you know, typical social situations where we're kind of put on the spot at a moment's notice. And so when you're interacting with people that are competing for a job that you really want, how are you authentic and how do you interact with them? And how do you, you know, cheer them on knowing that they may be the person getting the job? Right. And so I don't, you know, we don't always recommend that to cities, but when they do it, I've seen some real value in that because I think it does let you see a little bit more of the personal side, you know, how they're going to interact with, you know, their fellow team members. Are they humble? Are they able to be a leader and direct people, but still remain a servant leader? And I'll talk a little bit about servant leadership later if we have time, but
sure.
All of those things and getting to see people in a lot of different light in order for you to make that decision on, hey, this is a really good fit for our organization, is something we really try to support the community doing.
So you go through this process of doing the 8 or 10 candidates that have the video interviews, and then you get cut down to the final list, right? The selection committee. You work with the selection committee. You rank them. You, as the recruiter, you present your recommendations as far as a ranking, and then they pick them based off whatever metrics they want. They might go through recommendations. They might do their own thing, right? And then you get down to, what is it, usually 3-4 candidates, or I don't know if it's
it fluctuates. Four would be probably the most typical number.
Okay. Yeah. And then those folks get called in for an in-person interview, correct?
Right.
Uh-huh. Okay. Can you walk us through that process? Maybe obviously it might depend on the city itself, but is that generally a traditional, hey, we knock them all out in one day. You get assigned an hour to meet with the governing body. Maybe there's multiple panels. Can you walk us through that process?
Kind of depends on the governing body. Some people like to spend more time with each individual candidate. We have seen a lot of success in the one day long process. We always encourage the ability for the governing body to spend time with the candidates, but we also really want the staff, if we're making recommendations, having the opportunity for executive staff and then maybe some other members of staff to really meet the candidates and kind of, you know, talk about the challenges in the organization and things and get a feel for who their next leader may be as well. What that does is it allows the staff to really have some buy-in into who is eventually selected. And what we always tell councils is you shouldn't let your staff make the decision.
Right.
For instance, you know, I've had recently where a community hired an executive that the staff didn't recommend, but the council felt really good with. And I told council, I said, if you feel really good, that's fine. But make sure the staff understands you gave them a voice, you allowed them to participate in the process. And I think that's important for eventually, you know, setting up the leader for success. What I don't like to see often is, you know, if you just go in front of a hiring committee, like made up of council and mayor, and then the selection's made, sometimes people don't feel like it was very participative.
Right.
And so, so we try to encourage as much participation as we can get and be reasonable for the candidates. And then, you know, it's a deal where the candidates also evaluating the city.
Absolutely.
you know, it's you know, I want
if the candidate's smart, right? If the candidate's worth their salt, they should be interviewing the city. Absolutely.
Yeah. And we've had it, you know, sometimes where a candidate will go through the interview finalist interview process and then they will back out. And not, well, that's not, you know, what we want. If you really at the end of the day feel like it's not going to be the organization for you, then yeah, let's back out at that point because it's, you know, it's not going to be a good fit. You know, if you're truly feeling that.
Yeah. So when you have this process, are you encouraging or recommending as the recruiter that the city go through a certain process, like an all day deal? Is that your general recommendation? And then you just go based off if they push back and say, no, we want to do X, Y, or Z, you go that route? Or is that, walk me through that.
Yeah, we typically don't give a lot of recommendations up front about what the finalist interview should look like, to be honest. Okay. Typically, the hiring body, you know, the HR director and or the mayor and council sort of have a general idea. If they ask us and go, hey, what do you think? We'll go, hey, we've had some really good experiences with this. You know, we encourage, you know, like I said, the staff interviews. But we really, I think we try to be very careful on, you know, driving the interview process again, because it's all about ownership, because at the end of the day, we want them to feel like they had total ownership of that.
Understand. Are there anything that we want to talk about as far as the day of the interview and things that you've noticed with candidates, maybe some tips or tricks for putting your best foot forward? I mean, obviously I think that what we talked about, the big picture of building that relationship and connecting, obviously carries over even more so in person, obviously, but can we drill down into anything in more detail or granular level from what you've seen in your recruitments?
Yeah, you know, I've been really impressed with some candidates, even on what they wear. For instance, if you're interviewing for a community that's, you know, a very professionally dressed organization, if you've seen some of their council meetings and the you know, interim city manager or executive staff's wearing a suit and tie, then I would recommend you kind of dress at that. You know, if you watch a council meeting and the mayor and everybody's in jeans and a t-shirt, and it's kind of an environment where a suit and tie isn't, you know, something that's going to, you know, maybe garner, you know, a lot of support for you, maybe don't wear a tie, dress nice, you know, kind of a dress jacket, dress shirt. And I've seen that work in one community. You know, we were interviewing and it was a very professional community, but they didn't dress professionally all the time. And one of the candidates came in and he was the only one that wasn't wearing a tie. And, you know, in kind of the deliberations with council after that, they noticed it. They were like, hey, you know, this particular candidate, man, he wasn't wearing a tie. He was very comfortable. You know, he
and they liked that.
Yeah. They're like, he's one of us. You know, he fit in with us. And so I think, you know, if you really can do your research and go, hey, what type of community? Like I know in Wimberley's reputation was as ties aren't allowed. And you know, if you kind of look online. So when I went to my interview there, I didn't wear a tie because, you know, you just need to delve into that a little bit more and kind of go, hey, what does this community value? Not that I want to look sharp, but I don't want to overdress for an interview or underdress. Like, I mean, I certainly think coming off professional is important. So,
okay. Good one. Any other tips or things that you've noticed that helps the candidate put their best, or obviously even pitfalls or, you know,
Yeah. Well, I think spending some time in the community and being able to talk about that is important. Like, hey, you know, I either have brought my family or I came and I spent a day, you know, especially if it's somewhere where you haven't lived before or somewhere you don't live around, being able to come in and go, hey, I drove on some of your streets. I understand, you know, that there's these particular issues, or hey, I spent some time here at somewhere where I can envision myself and or my family being, I think really speaks volumes to your interest in the position. Because I think what a lot of hiring boards are like, you want to come here, you want us to pay you to be our, you know, chief executive, and this is your first time ever stepping into our community as this interview.
How often do you experience that, Mike? Because honestly, I would think that most candidates have done some, you know, previous visiting. I mean, obviously, if you're out of state, it can be a little bit difficult. You know, I've applied for, and I know this is tough, you know, because you only get so many vacation days and you have certain, you know, financial limitations, you know, but I've interviewed for a couple of jobs out of state. What I did honestly is I booked a couple of days early and I left a couple of days later, and I absorbed some of the cost out of my own pocket because it wasn't covered by the government body, only covered, you know, 2 days worth of travel or whatnot. But I wanted to have an idea of what the city looked like, be able to communicate that. And then, you know, I wanted to just spend some time there. What percentage of the candidates do you see coming in actually putting in that work? Because I would imagine it's pretty high, but maybe it's not.
No, I would say it's probably closer to 50-50. Like, you know, and I would say, you know, when an out-of-state candidate for us is applying, we want, it's not like we like, hey, this guy's coming from, you know, Pennsylvania, we're not going to consider him. There's some challenges for somebody coming in from out of state simply because of that issue, because they maybe haven't spent time in the community. So we always encourage people, try to come down, like you said, either a couple of days early, or maybe if you've even been down here or somewhere on a vacation before and you've driven through that community, you're like, oh man, this is a place I'd really like to live one day. Those things are where, because it's an investment. You know, I was in an interview not too long ago, and the candidate had done a pretty good job on the interview. And towards the end of it, they said, well, how long are you wanting to stay in our community? And he said, well, no more than 3 years. I'd really like to move back to the city I'm leaving. And it just, he didn't get the job. And afterwards I called and I told him, because in the discussions afterwards, the committee was like, hey, he did great, but we want somebody who's invested in us. And you know, in his perspective, it's like, well, I didn't want to lie. And I said, well, first of all, you don't know what's going to happen in 3 years. You may change your mind. You can answer that truthfully without making them sound like, hey, I'm just going to borrow you for 3 years and then I'm leaving. So like how you approach that matters, because they want you to love their community, and you want
absolutely
to, like, yeah, absolutely. You know, when you move somewhere, you want to be invested there.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah. That's a tricky one. Because you want to be honest, and you want to be, I guess also depends on where that city's at in the pecking order of size and compensation, right? It's one thing, you know, my first job, it was a very small community and very low pay. And I was very upfront and above board about, hey, this is a stepping stone community. And they were okay with that because they understood where they were, right? You know, understand, right, you know, what type of community they were. But if you're in a little bit more of an established community with a, you know, a little bit more of a cachet, you might want to be very careful about communicating like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think being prepared for that answer is something you should do. And you know, like I said, I think we need to be authentic and truthful, but how we present that matters. So, and that question is always going to generally come up.
There's two things I want to spin off of this little section of this conversation, and I'm going to hit. One is on spouse interaction and engagement, and the second one is just on Texas in general, right? So I'm going to come to Texas in general and then come back to the spouse part. A lot of people tell me, and this was also in the Jordan Cook interview, he'd heard the same thing, and I've been told this as well, is that it can be tough for out-of-state candidates, and you focus a lot in Texas. I don't think you're exclusively necessarily working in Texas, but I think your bread and butter right now is in Texas as far as your market share. But I've been told numerous times that Texas is a hard state for city managers to break into from outside the state. Do you have experience or thoughts on that, or is that a geographic thing, or can you touch on that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, we only do recruitments in Texas and Arkansas are the only two states. And really, because we want to be core focused on our candidates and really, you know, kind of a newer company, we haven't branched out. But my thoughts on Texas are, if you want to come from out of state, and we've interacted with a lot of folks who've applied from out of state, I think having an understanding of, you know, the unique tools that are in Texas, you know, particularly related to economic development, whether that's, you know, a TERS or 380, you know, and I know every state kind of has their version of that, but how do you, you know, make that work in Texas? Having, you know, the ability to come in and take your knowledge and then apply it to Texas, you need to be able to explain that. And, you know, it wasn't a city manager search, but we were doing a chief of police search for a city in South Texas, and they actually hired a chief that was coming from Chicago, Illinois. He did an amazing job of really talking about, you know, what he had done, first of all, to be able to get certified in Texas and had done a lot of that legwork up front, but in how he was going to lead with his knowledge that he had gained in Illinois. And so I think, you know, when a candidate can do that, I think it puts them on that level playing field. But if they feel like, or the hiring body feels like, you're going to have a lot of catch up to do, then it kind of puts you on the negative side. Because why hire somebody that's coming from out of state when I can hire a Texas city manager that is already ready to go?
So Texas has a reputation, right, of being, hey, this is Texas, don't mess with Texas, yada, yada. You know, the whole mystique, everything else, right? You know, bigger, better, all that stuff. Should out-of-state candidates feel like they have a realistic chance of getting a job in Texas, or is it really a long shot?
No, I mean, I think they have an opportunity, and we, you know, I think we have somebody that we know that got hired from a position from out of state down here in Texas, but they, like I said, did the legwork up front to be able to tell their story through the veil of Texas. And Texas is a very proud state, you know, especially when you're talking to council members who, you know, feel very invested in, you know, the Texas culture, you know, and Texas's ability to, you know, kind of lead in a lot of areas as far as growth and economic development and things. They're proud of that. And so if you're coming in, you need to be able to really show how your skill set works in that light. Okay. And those candidates that can't do that, I don't think they have a chance. Like if you're going to come in and go, hey, I want to manage like I manage, you know, in this state, you may not be as successful, because Texas does want you to come in and take some of that cultural stuff and be like, hey, I'm proud to be a new Texan myself. When you have that atmosphere, it's really easy to come into Texas, but it does take a lot of work.
I've talked about this on podcasts before about engaging the spouse, and obviously I've had some thoughts about whether or not spouse travel should be compensated and so forth and so on. What is your take, generally speaking, on either from the candidate's perspective of including their spouse versus the governing body in these recruitment processes? Do you have any thoughts on spouse interaction?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, we recommend that the city allow a candidate to bring their spouse and family if they choose to do so in that finalist interview process. Not everybody takes the opportunity to do that. This will just be my personal
opinion. You mean not every candidate takes that opportunity?
Not every candidate takes that opportunity.
Yeah.
Most cities that we recruit for are willing to, pay for the spouse's travel.
Oh, they are. Okay, yeah. Good. Okay.
Yeah. Kind of in our contracts, we put that in there that, the city will pick up for travel for the candidate and family, on their finalist interview trip. But candidates a lot of times either don't participate in that. I've had some candidates, ask, should I bring a spouse? And I think that's an answer where if your spouse is going to be actively involved in what you do, if they're going to be, attending the chamber events, if they're going to be, going to the council meetings, if they're going to be actively involved in your management style of that community, and you feel like they are going to be a positive light on you, then definitely bring them. If your spouse or your family, I've seen those managers who don't want their families involved in anything. And so if they're not going to be a part of your story, then I don't necessarily know that they add to the story. And I do think having, a spouse and a family come in and be supportive of that does help you tell your story. Because I do think that, they want to see you at the Kiwanis dinner. They want, you and your family to be, going to the high school football game, especially here in Texas on Friday night.
Absolutely.
And so they want to see those things, but we really just try to encourage the candidates to put your personal story is what you're demonstrating there. And if your spouse and family are a part of that story, then it's to your benefit to include them. If they're not, then, compete on what you are without that.
So let's move on to the selections made, right? Selections made. Are you at your firm in any way involved whatsoever with the negotiation contract portion of it? Or once they pick a finalist, do you guys just sort of exit stage left and let them hammer it out with the city attorney? Or walk us through that involvement.
Yeah, it's probably about 50-50. Some cities will ask us to be involved in it. And then if cities, want to negotiate without us, then we're happy just to step away at that point and let them do those negotiations. Sometimes, we have a general template that we'll send, just to kind of, especially we work with a lot of smaller communities. So maybe communities who haven't had an agreement with their city administrator or city manager before. So, we'll send kind of a template to them and their city attorney and kind of let them build from that or get involved. It's kind of a really fine line for us to walk because, again, we want the hiring body to feel like it was their hire, but we also, having been city managers, understand the importance of a good agreement. Now, we've seen some candidates ask for some astronomical things that we were just like very disappointed that they were asking for such things. And then a couple of times that has happened, those particular candidates didn't get the position. They went and kind of moved on to their second person on the list.
Yeah, because they're just unrealistic ask from your perspective.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, while having been a city manager, it's great to have that security there of understanding that something, that happens, quickly in a political environment, it gives you a little bit of time to figure out what you're doing in your career. There also can be the perspective of, and in one case, it may be that a city manager says that the hiring body can never fire them unless they're convicted of a felony.
Yeah.
And so like when you're asking for something like that. Yeah. So, I mean, you're kind of setting up every city council that comes in after that. There's a lot of in the government sector, you and I know that. I mean, that's maybe we need to give a little bit on that and kind of find something that fits for both the candidate and the community.
Yeah. There has to be a balance between, hey, we serve at the pleasure of the governing body, right? And they can get rid of us whenever they want in theory. Yeah. Right. But there just should be a decent cost or concession made so that the manager is getting something in return for exchanging that power to them, right? There's got to be, we're human beings and we have our families we got to take care of and, got to earn a living. And as you know, although I think you guys moved through your recruitments pretty quick, but a lot of these cities, man, they take six. Well, I mean, I got stories I could post right now about cities that have been looking for a city manager for, a year, two, 3 years even. It's not a fast process for a lot of these communities. And so, when you're a city manager and you're trying to find your next gig, you know, the odds of you being able to bounce out and get a hire 2 months later, it's not always there. And, you know, unless you're really fortunate. So you got to have a certain severance and what have you. I feel like I can't speak primarily to like small cities in Texas or whatnot, but I feel like Texas has gotten pretty close to the point where a year severance seems to be pretty common. Is that, can you speak on what you're seeing in the severance market when it comes to city managers in Texas?
Yeah. Anywhere between 6 months and a year is pretty frequent, you know, but we are seeing, you know, kind of trend towards that year in a lot of the newer agreements.
I know there's still some communities out there that are a little bit, you know, gun shy on even going up to 6 months, especially in the smaller communities. You know, I just spoke to this is not a Texas city manager, but I just spoke to a city manager this week, their first gig. And, unfortunately, they're going through a situation about 4 months into their tenure, and they didn't have a severance because it was their first gig, you know, and they made that, you know, that calculated risk, and now they're on the chopping block. And at the end of the day, if a city doesn't have to pay you any severance, there's really no disincentive for them to keep you, right? They can just, you know, change you out like a pair of underwear, unfortunately. What are your thoughts on what we're seeing in the macro picture when it comes to recruitment?
I think that there are a lot of candidates who understand the dysfunction in council. And so, what we tell city councils is how they interact with each other as a governing body is going to either really assist their recruitment or push people away. Because most people that are pretty active in the field are going to jump on and watch a council meeting or do their research before applying for a position. And so it can't generally be rescued by salary alone. If you have a very dysfunctional group as far as a governing body goes, it doesn't matter if you're paying $250,000 a year or $300,000 a year. It's still an enormous risk for, you know, a professional to jump into that environment knowing that they're probably not going to survive. What we really try to do is, you know, calm those councils down. We've recently started doing a lot of council workshops trying to go, hey, let's really talk about, you know, the difference between what the council should be doing and what the city manager should be doing. How do you build that trust, policy and administration, and kind of doing that to where they're set up for success coming in. But the general trend is, you know, I think My personal thought is information seems like it's cheap in our current culture. And by that, I mean, you know, we can jump online and find anything that we want to about anything. And so I think our council people are jumping on, and all of the solutions when you're jumping on Google look like they're pretty simple. You can get all the information about repairing a pothole or putting in a water line, attracting a Walmart to your community or not.
Yeah.
And so information's cheap. I mean, it's just out there. It's available.
I say it all the time. It's so easy a caveman can do it, right? It's just so easy.
And so I think it's hard for them to realize the importance of a professional city manager that can come in and tell them, you know, not only what they can read off of Google, but why you may or may not want to do something. You know, the implications of X could be, you know, 5 years down the road, something that's negative for your community.
Right.
And so it's a trend where professional city management is more needed than ever, but I feel like city councils don't feel like it's as valuable as it once was.
Yeah, true. Again, you're a relatively new entrant to the space, right? Been in it for a couple of years now. What kind of feedback are you getting from the governing bodies with respect to the candidate pool, either the quality or size of the candidate pools? And have you had any discussions with them? Are you setting expectations before you even go out and float the at job listing? Can you walk us through that? What's that? What kind of dynamic that is?
Yeah. You know, I think it's always great to be, you know, sort of a good steward of what we're doing with the councils. And, you know, I look as pay as one component of recruiting a good candidate to your city. It's an important component. So, you know, if a community is here in Texas, if they're only paying $125,000, that's going to only draw a certain number of candidates, because a lot of, you know, candidates in Texas can go make $150,000 or more and not a very differing population of cities.
Right.
But you know, some communities can only afford 125. So we try to help them understand that that's going to narrow the pool, not because it's, you know, a negative thing on the city. It's just, you know, there's a certain number of candidates who need to make, you know, the 150 or more, and kind of really setting them up for what their expectations are. We are typically really successful in our recruitments. And I think that's partly because we are a candidate focused company. Because we treat people a certain way, people will typically reapply with us for positions. They feel like we are open to everybody. Like we don't have a favorite list that we're trying to get, you know, specific people placed. When you apply, we really try to put as much of the ability on you to get the position. And it's kind of your own skills or techniques or ability to sell yourself that'll win or not. But I think that the more our reputation builds, and whether it's our firm or somebody else, if you have a good reputation of being fair with your candidates, you can get a good candidate pool. And so, you know, typically we'll see, you know, 35 to 40 candidates, even for our smaller communities. And now some of those people may not be fully qualified, but it allows us to kind of see a good, diverse candidate pool that comes in. But I do think it's really important for us to set expectations early with the governing body to where, you know, they're not expecting, you know, somebody to come in that's a city manager who has experience in a community like Plano, for instance, when they're paying $120,000.
Right, right. Or don't expect someone to have 10 years of experience to get coming right. for a $100,000 a year job, right? In this
right.
market, right? Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you touched on something a little bit too about the types of candidates and kind of being open, I think, to a broader array. Because I know there are some peers who feel like certain recruiters or recruiters, generally speaking, play it safe and go with the more traditional candidates as opposed to, say, someone with veteran experience or someone with non-traditional private sector experience. This kind of leads into a question that I got asked on my LinkedIn page from a gentleman who follows me. His name is Lawrence, about a past recruitment that he went through or was recruited to apply for a town manager position. And it's about the ICMA CDM credential. As you know, a lot of these larger organizations, they're being asked, or at least the listing says that they're looking for a city manager with an ICMA CDM credential. I have some thoughts on that. I think a lot of that's possibly being pushed by some of the recruiters that the cities aren't really asking for that themselves. I'm not 100% sure. I want to get your thoughts on that as well. But Lawrence asked this question about the ICMA CDM credential. And he says that he talked to this recruiter who had basically recruited him to apply for this position. And the recruiter had said that in no uncertain terms, in the over 100 local government recruitments that their firm had engaged in, was the lack of an ICMACM credential status a deciding factor in the board's hiring decision when it came to a manager. And they wanted to know your thoughts on the importance or significance of the ICMACM credential.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm very familiar with that credentialing. You know, I had actually worked really hard to get that and had reached the level where I should have been awarded it the same month I decided to retire from Wimberley. So I got an email from ICMA saying, hey, well, we're not going to award. I mean, I was on the list that they had sent out for the quarterly. Hey, these are the people going to be. And then they sent me an email after I retired and said, hey, you're no longer a city manager, so you're out. But, you know, I understand the work and dedication it takes to, you know, kind of getting that credentialing. And what I would say is we don't specifically list that credentialing as the end all be all. For us, it's what have you been doing to grow yourself in your position? And that might be, you know, I've been a city manager for 10 years, but I've, you know, went to, you know, this type of training where I've really focused on growing my leadership skills here. But what I definitely recommend people do is, well, there was one candidate who didn't get selected as a semifinalist for us. And he sent me a long email about his past experiences and very impressive candidate. And when I responded to him, I really wanted to say, you know, I'm impressed with your history. Thank you for your service. Cause I get it. He's an impressive guy, but he hadn't been to training in 30 years, like nothing, like not anything. And when the hiring committee
didn't show any professional development, advancement, anything like that.
None. Yeah. None. And so, and what I tried to tell him is when a hiring committee looks at that, they're like, how is this person investing? And I realize we're all busy, but you have to be investing in your own professional development, no matter what position you are in an organization. And so if that's, you know, ICMA and you're becoming a credential manager, because there's some training that goes into that, then, you know, that's one way to demonstrate that. Or if there's another way, whether it's, you know, like a certified public manager program or just another type of leadership program you're going through, and not even have to be leadership. Maybe you're working on your economic development certification.
Yeah. Self-directed or, sort of training or course, right? I mean,
I think that's super important for people to realize that the leader that they're hiring is going to consistently be in trying to improve themselves.
Right.
So I don't necessarily think that one credential is the end all be all. I think it may be recognizable and a little bit easier to explain to some people, but I think as long as you have something and you can, you know, add that as part of your story, then it's equally as good.
So when you go through these recruitments, and I'm not sure how many you've done for managers at this point, have you ever had a governing body say, hey, we want an ICMA CM manager, or is it usually something that's brought up by you, or has that even come up at all?
No, it hasn't came up for us at all. And I think we did around 20 recruitments since we've been in, and it's never come up. And again, we, as a newer firm, you know, most of our communities are 50,000 or less population.
Right.
So we haven't recruited for, you know, some of the maybe larger communities. But I think there's some large bias when it comes to, you know, people. And I always kind of get offended because I worked in a large city, not as a city manager, before I moved to being a city manager in smaller communities. Those larger, you know, cities will say, well, hey, we want a manager who's been a manager in a city similar sized or above, right? Yeah. And what I always tell them is, man, I'll tell you, I worked as a smaller town city manager so much harder than I had to in that larger community. And I know I wasn't the top dog, but I'm like, you know, you have to be a budget analyst. You have to be, you know, public safety expert. You're expected to be so many things.
Yeah.
And you don't have a staff to rely on. So I always try to encourage governing bodies to be open. Like, and I don't think I'm going to use a particular individual that I'm very impressed with because we talked about military. We had the opportunity to work with an individual called Dalton Rice.
Yeah.
Who's the new city manager in Kerrville.
He's a rising Dalton, star. He made a big jump. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was in a smaller community and jumped to a little bit, you know, larger of a community. And people had, you know, I'll run into somebody at a Texas city manager luncheon and they'll be, well, how did Dalton get, you know, picked for that? Well, Dalton was a veteran, a very impressive veteran, you know, and that part of his leadership story and resume, he did a really good job of explaining how that positioned him to become a good leader for a city organization. So although his city manager tenure hadn't been long or for a big city, again, he had developed a story that resonated with that community he was interviewing with. We've been involved in a lot of military, you know, veterans that are candidates getting hired. And I think it's just important for those folks to be able to demonstrate how they grew in that experience and then, you know, how they're going to transition that into, you know, leading a community.
Right. How those skills are relatable and transferable. Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Hey, Mike, I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about servant leadership. You mentioned it a little bit earlier in the podcast. And so we're kind of rounding up here at the end of the interview. Go ahead and give you the floor. Go ahead and talk about it.
I think leadership is such an important discussion for people who are in on a governing body, though, because they want to feel comfortable when they, you know, are away or when they're in bed that the city is being operated by somebody who is a quality leader. And so I think there is so much information about leadership out there that gets misused. And so we do, I talked a little bit about this. We do a one-page leadership profile and talk about pet peeves. It's somebody that'll just go in and go, I'm a servant leader. And I think that term is so overused because I think that is a core value you may have. Maybe you do have a servant's heart, which can be a very good thing as a leader, but how you play that out into your leadership story is really important. And I think I've been kind of kicking around the idea of writing a book on leadership because it's a passion of mine. I get really frustrated because, you know, I think people will take little parts of a bunch of different leadership stories and then they'll try to, you know, talk about those in an interview. And it isn't authentic. That's not who they truly are. Authenticity for me is probably one of the best leadership concepts that I truly am who I say I am. And, yeah. And if I can communicate that, then that's, you know, a big jump. But I just want to say, like, if you're answering a question on an interview panel and they're like, hey, what sort of leadership style do you have? Or how are you going to lead our organization? If your only answer is servant leadership, then it's not very impressive.
You've heard it before, right?
Right. Yeah. Definitely be able to expand on that. Saying, like, I'm not saying it's not a negative thing. It's just don't let that be the only thing.
Yeah. Or if you're going to bring that up, maybe you got to crush that, right? Just really go above and beyond to articulate what servant leadership truly means down to your core, right? Core philosophy as a leader, not just repeating some platitudes or regurgitating some fortune cookie cliches in a job interview, right? Oh, yeah, man. Yeah. All right. Hey, Mike, is there any final things you'd like to say or communicate to the audience?
I'm just really excited to be a part of your show. I really like what you're doing. I think the thing that I really think is important in our culture, especially in government, is the opportunity to hear a number of different perspectives and then critically filter that information for our own, you know, values and our own systems. And so I really love the platform that you have that presents a lot of information and then allows, you know, your readers or your subscribers to kind of vet through that information themselves. Because I think having a critical eye is a skill that's been, you know, diminishing over the years. And I think it's so important for our field as people are looking to, you know, people in the government to be examples of where we should, you know, bring our communities and our culture. And I think it's really important for us to be able to look at a lot of different things. And you provide one of the rare opportunities. You know, the death of the local media has been one of the worst things that has ever happened to cities, because there's no good way to get your story out. And, you know, social media can run good people, you know, into the ground quickly because there's no alternative source of information. And so I really, you know, appreciate what you're doing, Joseph. And thanks for letting me be on the show. We're honored. You know, my team that I work with at Clear, We're honored to be, you know, a part of your story. You know, we really want to value what we do and be impactful for the candidates and the cities we work for. So it's just awesome to be a part of it, man. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate that.
Thank you. You know, it's something one of the best compliments I think I get all the time, at least I think it's one of the best compliments, is, you know, I got a lot of reviews and ratings on the podcast on Apple and whatnot, and are just comments in general, even messages I'll get. People say, you know, I don't agree with everything you say, but I appreciate the fact that you're willing to talk about certain topics that other people aren't. And, you know, there was a, you know, I'm 46 going on 47, and man, there was a time in this country where people could actually have differences of opinion and it wasn't a personal thing. You didn't have to hate the person or question their motives or their quality of the quality of them as a human being if you happen to have a difference of opinion. You know what I mean? And it's like, I don't want everyone to agree with me. If everyone agreed with me, that'd be pretty boring, you know? And I don't expect or want that. So I love the fact that people can feel comfortable disagreeing with me, that they can state an oppositional viewpoint without me jumping down their neck. If you're pro ICMA and you want to say I'm pro ICMA, that's fine. Come on and tell me you're pro ICMA, you know? Just don't get all butthurt if I give you some anti ICMA comments, or if I talk about this, or if I talk about that. So no, I appreciate you coming on, but you know, one of the real reasons why I'm very appreciative of you is just the fact that you talked about that candidate focus. And that's just something I've just been preaching about since day one of this LinkedIn journey and this podcast journey, is being an advocate for the managers. And, you know, like I said, I'm repeating myself from earlier in the interview. I understand you work for governments and those are the ones that pay your bills. I get it. But there's nothing wrong with being focused on the candidate and making sure that we're treated with respect and dignity and like human beings, right? We're human beings. We're going through a very stressful time when we're applying for jobs. A lot of us, when we're applying for positions, might be out of work. Obviously, there's some financial stresses there that go along with that, uprooting our families and so forth and so on. And I just don't think it's too much to ask for a recruiter to be in communication with on a regular basis. I mean, are you really that big or important that you can't talk to 30 candidates, you know, on a couple of recruitments that you're doing at any given time? I mean, I don't know. So I really do appreciate that. And Mike, I really appreciate you putting the candidates first when you are engaging with them. I've experienced it myself firsthand. So I definitely can highly recommend that you are not just talking the talk, you are walking the walk. And so I appreciate you and thank you for being on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I did want to say, you know, I had an opportunity to talk to a candidate yesterday and tell him he didn't get the job. And it actually ended up, you know, being a really good story, because what I did tell him was that I really appreciated everything that's accomplished so far in his career. And I really just tried to give him, you know, kudos to his, you know, journey so far. And it ended up being an amazing experience because, you know, sometimes in telling people they didn't get a position, it's looked at as negative. And sometimes people do take it that way. But sometimes they take it for what it is, that, you know, you weren't the fit. But, you know, as a fellow professional that's been in the seat, to recognize people and just make them feel like they are contributing and that people are noticing they're contributing, you know, I think can sometimes make their day, and at least, you know, give them the ability to continue on their journey and you know, put in for another position of leadership. And it's so needed in our field to recognize each other as you know, professionals, and really recognize that our relationships are what make us better people. And so I appreciate the opportunity to be involved with people. And I know it's when you apply for a position, you trust the recruiter. And that's, you know, something that we take very, very important in our values, is thank you for that trust for those people. So again, thanks again, Joseph. And man, it's been great. And I look forward to seeing all the things that, you know, the good Lord is going to bring you in the coming year.
Thank you, sir. Mike Bays with Clear Career Professionals, and thank you for being with us. I'm Joe Turner. This is the City Manager Unfiltered Podcast, a podcast for city managers and other public sector executives. Thank you for joining us. If you like the show, if you appreciate what I'm doing, please take a moment to leave a review on Apple, especially. I'm trying to get to the 200 mark. I'm up at 170 right now. I'd be really honored to get to 200 before the one-year anniversary. It's a pretty impressive accomplishment that I'd be very proud of. So if you do like the program, please leave a rating and review. It'd mean a lot to me. And catch you on the next episode. Thank you.